This episode is brought to you in part by the Table Podcast from the Hendricks Center at Dallas Theological Seminary. I'm Daryl Bach, one of the hosts, and I invite you to join us as we discuss issues of God and culture, which includes anything and everything. Listen on your podcast app or at dts.edu/thetable.
We spend a lot of time on podcasts like this predicting the future in various ways. But as we do that, we know life is really unpredictable. And as the scripture says, we do not know the number of our days. And that's why it's a really important thing to have a will, to protect yourself and your family. Christianity Today has partnered with Epic Will to walk you through the entire process of creating a will in as little as 10 minutes. You don't have to have a law degree to be able to walk through this, and that's why it's really helpful. So visit morect.com, that's morct.com, will, that's morect.com/will to get started today. To the Russell Moore Show from Christianity Today. Every week, we get together here for questions and conversations from a Christian perspective. And this is one of those weeks where we turn to your questions. And before we get to the questions, let me just say to our listeners, if there's something that you're wondering about, maybe it doesn't have to be a big existential crisis, although it can be, but it might just be something that you've come across in the Bible and you think, I don't know how to understand that, or maybe it's a relationship situation where you're thinking, I'm trying to figure out how to navigate this, or a workplace sort of ethical matter, any of those things, send it to questions@russellmoore.com and we'll do our best to answer them. And I'm joined, as always, by our producer, Ashley Hales. Ashley, how are you?
I'm doing great. It's fun to be here. We have lots of questions about relationships, it seems like. That seems to be some of the theme, family life, and what does that look like? One woman writes in asking a question kind of on behalf of her daughter. Her daughter is dating a young man, and he's kind of feeling this beginning call to be a pastor. And this mother of the young woman, says she's unsure, as she assumes other young people are, as to whether they're compatible for life. And she says that your dad's warning to you about people hurting others in ministry has often come to her mind. So she's wondering if your wife could recommend any resources to help her know about what she might be signing up for if they choose to marry one day.
Well, I think a couple things. I mean, the first thing is, yes, my dad told me when I went to him and I was a nervous wreck. It was really difficult. And I think it's kind of like other people I know who have to go to their dad and say, I've been arrested or something like that, for me to go and to say, I think God's calling me into ministry, not because he was negative toward ministry or the church, but because he was a pastor's kid who grew up in a parsonage next door to a church, and he saw what had what his dad lived through in that context. And he just said, look, I'm not going to bring this up again. I'm not going to ever, if you decide that this is what God's called you to do, I'm going to support you completely and I'll never mention it again. And he never did. He was always supportive from that point on. And there were many times when he could have said, see, this is what I was talking about. Yeah. He never did any of that. So I think that I'm glad that he did that. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that it didn't scare me away from ministry.
Yeah.
So both of those things are true. Yeah. So I think for this mom, saying to her daughter, be careful, is a good thing. But I think that can only go to a certain point.
Right.
And then step back. And in terms of resources, I think the best resources are not going to be things to read or to watch as much as it's going to be to talk to people who've been in that situation. And so find some people who are ministry spouses in some way or the other and say, what has this experience been like for you? And then to step back and say, am I able to sign up for this and to and to live with this? Having said that, what I would say is talk to more than one person and don't put yourself necessarily into the same category as the church might expect of you or even other people might expect of you. So there are a lot of, I mean, I've seen this happen a lot in sort of the world that I come out of Southern evangelical churches, in which a lot of times the expectation is the pastor's wife is going to serve as, is going to play the piano and is going to be in charge of the Women's Missionary Union and is going to do all of these specific things because that's what they have seen a pastor's spouse doing. And a lot of times what it takes is to say, I'm not going to fit into necessarily all of your expectations and stereotypes. I'm going to be me. And that often changes the expectations and stereotypes over time. And so don't get really boxed into to that. But I think it takes some knowledge of what it's like. And it is ministry is it's hard to communicate how ministry is the most life-giving and thrilling in the right way sort of thing. And it is also absolutely horrific and soul crushing. And then the other thing I would say is if your daughter does decide to go in this direction, if she marries this man and that's what he's called to, I would say from the very beginning, cultivate friendships with some people who are in the same situation that you can remain connected to for life. Because what happens in ministry is you get into a place where you say, okay, I can't talk to any of my people in my church about this. I also can't, sometimes in a lot of communities, they think I can't talk to the other ministers in the community or ministry spouses in the community because they're all "quote unquote competitors," you know. Even if you know, I shouldn't think of them that way, and they shouldn't think of me that way. It often is the case. So find people that you can talk to and just call and say, "Can you believe this is happening?" I mean, sometimes it's not even to say, "Give me some advice." Yep. It's just, I just need somebody that I could talk to who to make me realize, okay, I'm not insane.
Right.
You really need that.
Yes. You can, the listener can go ahead and email me too. So I've been married to a pastor for we've been married for 20 years and he's pastored for most of those. And what you're saying rings exactly true. You know, having people where you can let your hair down with, you know, I've often thought, it's a grace and a burden, right, to be so tightly connected to the local church. So I think it's a particular call. But we never know what we're signing up for when we get married.
Well, that's right. And that's I was having a conversation one time. A group of us were there, and one of the people there was in ministry, and he said, you know, I don't know what to do. I don't know whether to leave. And somebody had said, well, you know, just remember your calling, remember your ordination vows. And he said, yeah, but I mean, I was 19.
Right.
He said, I wouldn't trust a 19-year-old to give me any directions in my life. So why do I trust my 19-year-old self to have set the whole trajectory of my life? And I understood that, but there's a sense in which that's what all of us do.
Right.
We make decisions that lead to the next decision. And
here we are.
We trust the providence of God with that. Yeah.
Amen.
Ashley here. If you're looking for another podcast that features inspiring conversations with religious leaders, authors, and artists, then I recommend listening to the acclaimed podcast, No Small Endeavor. Produced by Great Feelings Studios and PRX, No Small Endeavor explores what it means to live a good life. Each episode, host Lee C. Camp sits down with special guests, like award-winning journalist and best-selling author Tim Alberta and civil rights hero Reverend James Lawson, to ask what it means to live a life worth living. You can even hear from Russell Moore on No Small Endeavor. If you're looking for somewhere to start, check out their new episode with Malcolm Gladwell, New York Times best-selling author and host of the wildly popular podcast Revisionist History. They explore how Malcolm became a stellar storyteller, some of the things he may or may not regret, and so much more. Don't miss out. Follow No Small Endeavor wherever you get your podcasts.
So, you know, as we think about marriage and call, there's also a question here about sex from one of the listeners here, and saying, you know, this listener didn't feel like he was really prepared well and to educated and knowing how to think biblically about sex, how we might develop a better understanding of the nature of sex, as well as kind of some of the debates in sexual ethics, like family planning and contraceptives. So he's just asking, basically, given that he didn't hear a lot or wasn't educated a lot from his parents concerning the issues of sex, where do we begin to engage that in scripture? And then how do we begin to engage questions of sexual ethics more broadly?
Well, it's kind of like anything else. Often people will make their decisions on the basis of slippery slopes. So there's a slippery slope over there that can lead to something else. And a lot of times people don't realize there's slippery slopes all around something. And so in this case, you sort of probably need to start by asking, which of those slopes am I on? Or am I more likely to be on? Because you can have one person who has who is coming out of a cultural environment that has a very casual view of sex and sexuality, or a really 21st century American culturally conditioned understanding of sexuality. And in that case, you really need to lean into learning what the Bible teaches about the limits and boundaries of sex and sexuality. But you might also have grown up in a situation where what you heard about sex was just don't do this, don't do these immoral things, and you may have come away from that with a sense that sex is bad or dirty or those sorts of things, and there might be that kind of awkwardness. And one of the things that I find is that that second category often leads to a lot of pornography addiction. Or those sorts of things, because people, husband and wife, start to get awkward with one another, or maybe they start out awkward with one another, which is fine. That's okay. That's the way it works. Don't worry about that. But sometimes people, they panic about that, and they start trying to find some other outlet that isn't in God's design, and that ends up making the problem. Not only is it immoral, but it makes the problem so much worse.
Yeah.
So see if that's sort of the place you're in, or if you're in a place, there are some people who have tried to overcorrect for both of those things. And what they do is to come in with treating Song of Solomon as a sex manual, for instance. I mean, I think of a lot of the stuff that Mark Driscoll was doing back in the day, with a sense of, you know, and you can have that on a lower level. People It just drives me crazy when people get up and say, oh, here's my smoking hot wife or right. my smoking hot. And that's just, yeah. It might be that that's where mm-hmm. you have heard all of this. And a lot of that leads to disappointment.
Right.
Because you start to have this understanding that, wait a minute. If our sex lives aren't amazing and sort of Song of Solomon starts imprinting on my mind, you know, then you end up with mm-hmm. a situation where people start to feel as though they're being cheated of the most important thing in mm-hmm. life, in their view. Right. And that can lead to a lot of conflict, or that can lead to adultery. I've seen that happen a lot. So just ask yourself where mm-hmm. you are on that spectrum, and then step back and understand how the Bible is talking about sex and sexuality. So what you have in sex, what sex is intended to be, is a one flesh covenant union. That's the reason why a lot of people will say, I just don't understand how with premarital sex and then suddenly a switch flips and now it's okay and it wasn't before. Well, it's not a switch flipping. It's a question of covenant. And that question of one flesh union, that's why. Because what God is designing in Genesis 2, therefore a man shall leave his mother and father, cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Then you go into the New Testament, and the Apostle Paul explains why that is in Ephesians chapter 5. Because that one flesh union is representing a mystery, and that mystery is of Christ and his church. So it's covenantal giving of one to the other, and it's an icon. Yeah. This is an icon. And so when that's tampered with in various ways, you distort the icon, you distort the mystery, and you end up in a place where you think that what you're doing is filling some sort of longing and need by going outside of those one flesh union mm-hmm. boundaries, and you end up hurting yourself. Mm-hmm. And so I would say just spend some time reflecting on what that is. Mm-hmm. And for some people, what you need to what you need to really be looking at is, okay, we really need to work on in our marriage having a healthy and regular sex life. And sometimes the reasons that those don't happen is because you've got maybe small children, you're both working really stressful jobs, and you just don't have time. Step back and say, okay, we need to work. This is not incidental. This is important. We need to work on mm-hmm. that. And for some people, it ought to be, I've got two high of a priority on this. Because sometimes when people, they first get married and it's, you know, you're in this hormonal sort of surge where it's, we just want to be together all the time and to stare into each other's eyes and my heart flutters when the other person comes into the room, all of that. Then when that starts to change, you think, oh, it's growing cold. I'm losing it. We're falling out of love. When really you're just maturing into the next stage where it's not the hormonal kind of, but it's a really deep connection. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get that, then what's going to happen is people start to say, well, we're not in love with each other anymore. Right. So let me find the person who does give me that sense of hormonal kind of rush. Yeah. And a lot of that is usually just the drama of it that kind of puts you back in a place where you once were.
Yeah.
A lot of when I'm dealing with marriages that have been split apart by adultery, The spouse who's cheated on always thinks that's because they weren't attractive enough. Mm-hmm. That is, in my experience, that has never been the case.
Yeah.
It's the sort of feeling that somebody gets with a, mm-hmm. I like you, do you like me? That kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really dangerous.
Yeah.
And so see whether or not that's your expectation. And if it is, bring that under control and awareness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think you make such a great point about, you know, that sex is actually, when you're talking about it as an icon, you know, that then is saying that all of my relationships, and particularly the marriage relationship, is actually subservient to my relationship with Jesus. And a more modern kind of American view, right, would be that actually sex is a need. And so it's primarily individualistic. So I think that's just a really helpful way to begin to unpack how some of our damaging ideas about sex and marriage and relationships really are stemming from either the sense that I get to control my life or if Christ is king. So thank you for helping frame that.
Yeah, or the understanding of this is nothing, therefore mm-hmm. what difference does it make? Or this is everything.
Right.
And therefore it has to. So I think it's not just you have to balance. Ephesians 5 is lifting this up and showing you how cosmically significant it is. Mm-hmm. Mark 12, when Jesus is being confronted by the religious leaders and they give him this example of a woman who mm-hmm. has been married, her husband dies, she marries again, husband dies, has seven husbands, which husband will she be the mm-hmm. wife of?
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to trap Jesus into what would appear to be a ridiculous situation. And what does Jesus say? He says, in the kingdom of God, there's not marrying and giving in marriage, but we are like the angels in heaven. So marriage and sex, these are very important things. These are not ultimate things.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to keep that
in
balance all the time.
Well, for our last question, it's a yet another kind of relational question about a mom writing in about her thoughtful, intelligent, sensitive ninth grader. And he's going to public school for the first time. And, you know, they see things in one way politically. They're kind of against a lot of this sort of Christian nationalism, but a lot of that still is kind of lurking in their community. And so And so she's asking the question on behalf of her son. He's in this new environment. He's sensitive. He's thoughtful. And he's trying to make friends too, right? So he's a teenager trying to sort that out. And so she asks, you know, his friends are seeing things differently than him politically. And a lot of them aren't Christians. And so she would ask you, what kind of resources or words of encouragement might you have towards those younger folks about how to work through and verbalize their thoughts in generous ways to their friends, and to begin to maybe challenge some of those beliefs, but not in ways that would really, you know, elicit violence or hatred or some of the stuff maybe that we see on social media where we're just slandering one another. What does that look like in those years?
So is he encountering this Christian nationalism and that sort of thing in the public school?
It sounds like that's part of the community, that there is a sense of how could you not vote for Trump or, at least that this was sort of in the soil.
Yeah, I think a lot of that's going to be contextual in terms of that particular family. I know in our case, just because we've been so public about what we think about some of these things, it almost prevents some of those relational kinds of divisions, because people who would disagree with us on this stuff know where we are.
Yeah.
And they're not, I mean, a lot of the people in our kind of community are not immature, cruel sorts of people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they do what any of us would do and say, okay, we're going to talk about other things. But when you come to, but one of the things though that you really do want to model and to teach your children is not to just merge into the hive, because that's going to be important for them later on, not in terms of politics necessarily, but in terms of just all the decisions that they're making in their lives. So if you've got this sensitive ninth grader, what you probably don't, if I've got the right sort of read and vibe on this kid in my mind, what you don't want to do is to prepare him with talking points to be able to argue with people on specific issues. And a lot of times that's what parents think they need to do.
Yeah.
My ninth grader needs to be able to demonstrate that Christian nationalism is a heresy to the kids, and it is, to somebody over here, and needs to be able to argue against an abortion rights supporter who says that that an unborn child is just tissue. They need to be able to make those arguments. I don't think that in most cases is what you want to do. What you want to do instead is to enable him to come in and to find friends, and there will be people in any community who are their lives aren't driven by politics or culture wars, to find those people and then to help him to evaluate on his own why it is that people hold to the various different viewpoints that they hold, and how to differentiate between, okay, here are things that are going to take you into a really bad direction. So I'm going to make sure that I'm giving you the direction where you don't get radicalized by the crazy right or the crazy left. But it's to give a sense of empathy. What is it in people that causes a longing for which Christian nationalism is the answer, or for which democratic socialism is the answer, or whatever it is in your context? Help them to see that and walk them through it, but don't equip them to be able to culture war better.
No.
I don't think that's the answer.
That's a good line. I like it.
What I loved most of all about Israel and why I became a Zionist was because Zionism was a rejection of victimhood.
A few weeks ago on CT's The Bulletin, we launched Promised Land, a new podcast about Israel and Palestine in a post-October 7th world.
6:30 a.m., we're in our synagogue praying, and sirens go off, and they're going on.
Based on interviews and conversations captured on the ground in Israel last November, it's an exploration of the spiritual, political, and historical roots of the conflict.
When there's a weak Israel, every Jew in the world is weak.
And why should a Russian Jew who has nothing to do with this land come here? Why? Well, I mean, if you want, you can give them Texas. You love them so much.
I am alive because I didn't come home. But all my friends that were here were murdered. Here, over there.
This week, Promised Land moves to its own feed. You'll find links in the show notes. So if you haven't heard it yet, you can go catch up and catch the new episodes as they come, all in one place.
Oh, so as we conclude, would love to know, what has been one of your most fun things about raising teenagers and young adult children?
I love raising teenagers. Yeah. I mean, and I think people would give us all of these, oh, just wait till they're teenagers. But I realized that looking back, there are always those people doing that with everything. I mean, there were people, oh, just wait till you're married. And then you get married. It's, oh, just wait till that first year. Mm-hmm. Get through the first year. And we're like, this is this is good. But that's just because you're newlyweds. Just right. Wait until you've been married for 10 years. Just wait till you have kids. Just wait till they're terrible twos. Just, you know, you eventually realize there are people who just want to make sure everybody's as miserable as I am right now.
Right.
And so a lot of people would do that with the teenage years. And I have loved it because you end up with a sense of I'm really seeing who you are or who you are going to be in a new way.
Yeah.
And that's great. The difficult parts about it are, first of all, I told my wife the other day that this was the most surprising thing for me about raising children, is that I miss them. And what I mean by that is that I'll go back and I'll look at pictures and I will say, I wish that I could have a reunion with Jonah as a 1-year-old and a 10-year-old and now, and to have, you realize how quickly this moves by. That's difficult. And the middle school years are difficult for everybody.
Yeah.
And we kind of learned, we have 5 sons, so you eventually, you kind of just learn by experience what's worthy of panic and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just sort of, okay, this is just what middle school is like.
Right. Yeah.
And I've had to say, I say to my kids now when they start hitting that age, is to say, look, there are some people who are kind of living in the past, nostalgic about high school or college. There's nobody nostalgic for middle school.
That's good.
It's hard for everybody, but it's not permanent.
Right.
You really are going to get through this.
Yeah.
That's important. And I would also say, though, one of the challenges of the teenage years is that it's easy to lose connection because there was a time when you were really busy and the kids were always there. And then suddenly that shifts where the kids are really busy. Maybe they're working a part-time job and going to school and dating or whatever else. It can be really easy just to kind of lose touch with one another. Find those ways to keep connection. And one of the ways I've found that really works is driving together on kind of car trips one-on-one because you can have conversations that might be awkward if you just sat down and said, we're going to, or if not awkward, they can just seem like there's a lot at stake.
Right. Too intense.
That doesn't when you're sort of sitting side by side talking when you're driving down the road. Mm-hmm. That's just worked for us.
Oh, that's a great one. And I've heard too that often men, they relate better like shoulder to shoulder and women face to face. And so I wonder too with your sons, if part of that shoulder to shoulder is a thing.
To some degree, but and one of the things that we learned, and I don't know because I don't have any daughters and I have 5 sons, but I can tell you I've noticed how different each of the 5 are from each other.
Yep.
And so there are ways in which there are some ways that I can relate to Samuel, who's really, he's really sort of... hard driven, very, very firm moral compass, really hard on himself in terms of making sure that he's doing the right thing and achieving and so forth. And then I have Jonah, who is cool and chill. And I used to say when he was a kid, he's easy to please, hard to impress, which means that there can sometimes be things that he's needing that he's not going to say because he's really agreeable and you have to really dig for that.
Yeah.
So they're really different a lot
they
of times,
are. Yeah.
Even though they're from the same family and the same environment.
Yes.
And you just have to kind of figure that out over time.
Yes, I agree. My 3 sons are all very different as well. So thank you.
And what are their ages?
My oldest is in 9th grade. He's 15, Ezra. And then Porter, we have an eighth grader. And then Camden, it's 10. And then I have a girl to round us out in third grade, Harriet. So yeah, okay. It's pretty fun. It's crazy at the Hales house. But thanks for encouraging us.
Well, I want to encourage our listeners to send to your questions to us about anything that you're grappling with or wondering about at questions@russellmoore.com. Won't use your name unless you tell us to, but whatever it is that you're grappling with, whether it's big or small. And be sure to tap the cover art for other resources that might be of help to you. Subscribe, leave a review. Helps folks to find us, and send it to somebody that you think might benefit. Maybe a parent of some teenagers or a newlywed or somebody who's trying to grapple with decisions about life, since we talked about so many of those things in this episode. And we will be back next week for more questions and conversations. This is Christianity Today's Russell Moore Show. This is Russell Moore.
The Russell Moore Show is a production of Christianity Today. Executive producers are Eric Petrick, Russell Moore, and Mike Cosper. Hosted by Russell Moore, produced by Ashley Hales. Associate producers Abby Perry and Azrae Phelps. CT administration provided by Christine Kolb. Social media by Kate Lucky. Director of operations for CT Media is Matt Stevens. Production assistance provided by Core Media. Audio engineer is Kevin Duthu. Coordinator is Beth Grabencourt. Video producer is John Roland. The theme song for The Russell Moore Show is Dusty Delta Day by Lennon Hutton.